we've talked over the last couple of episodes of this series. We've talked quite a lot about the Waldenses, the Waldensians. What happened to them? What happened to the Waldensians? They're actually still around. I'll talk some more about that later on. They're still around. But why don't we consider them as Church of God's brothers and sisters anymore? I'm going to talk about that today and answer those questions. Last time, in part 14, we left the churches, both the true churches and the false churches, back in the dark and Middle Ages. But today I want to speed forward from then to the 16th century, because from everything that I've read on this, the 16th century was when the next big departure from the faith once delivered came about. But perhaps surprisingly, it appears to have come, like this break from the truth, seems to have come about as a result of the Protestant Reformation. And the main part of the Protestant Reformation was begun by Martin Luther in Saxony, which is now Germany, part of Germany, in the year 1519. Luther's departure from the Roman Catholic Church was followed just 15 years later, in 1534, by what I think of as Brexit 1. And that was the departure of King Henry VIII of England from the Roman Catholic Church. And that's when he started setting up, or having set up, the Church of England. Before we go into the effects of the Protestant Reformation on the true Church of God, I first need to say something about Henry VIII and Martin Luther. And I want to say something about the very beginnings of their Protestant movements. They're parallel, pretty well parallel Protestant movements. Let's get Henry out of the way first. I think that we all know about Henry VIII. I think we all know that, unlike Luther, Henry did not split off from the Roman Catholic Church for anything like pious reasons, for anything like sincere doctrinal reasons or differences. It's true that he was peeved, and rightly so, at his British subjects being ruled to a great extent by a bunch of misogynists 900 miles away in Rome. But the bottom line for Henry was that he just wanted to dump an unproductive wife and replace her with another one, hopefully a more fruitful one, and another, and another, and another. But the Pope and his cronies were having none of that. They wouldn't let Henry do it. So Henry, and I think about Henry as the Donald Trump of the 16th century, he just merely removed the barriers to his personal desires, and he just went ahead with what he wanted to do. Okay, that's Henry. What about Luther? Luther is more significant to the scattering of the true Church of God, which is what we're talking about. And the first thing we need to remember about Martin Luther is that prior to the Reformation, he was a Roman Catholic priest and monk. He had no idea of what he was going to do, and the huge impact that he was going to have. He didn't have an idea that, as far as we know, that he was going to break away from the Roman Catholic Church. He just wanted to reform it, and that's why we've got the word Reformation. I'm sure that you've all heard about the 95 Theses of Martin Luther. I think I've got a copy of it on the table there somewhere, do I? Somewhere hanging around the table there. Anyway, Martin Luther thought up these 95 theses. They weren't all of it, the ideas that he came up with, obviously, but he wrote them out and he nailed them up on the door of a church building in a place called Wittenberg, which is in Saxony, now part of Germany. How many of us have actually read them? And again, you know, if you're so inclined, you can read them today. I had not read them until a couple of weeks ago when I looked them up on the internet, found an English version of them and printed them out, and I was quite surprised what they actually said. Thinking about the 95 theses, just like Luther's Protestant theology generally, these 95 theses were the beginning of it, and they do contain a few points that are in agreement with the Word of God, but they contain much more that is not scriptural. They contain much more that sticks to Luther's old Roman Catholic tenets, and they contain much more that Jesus and his true spiritual brothers and sisters would not agree with. It's important to remember that. The subsequent Lutheran churches that came about from the Reformation and the other Protestant churches, including Henry's Church of England, hung on to many of the old Roman Catholic errors and abominations, and still do to this very day. If you ever have the opportunity to not just in Europe, but right here in North America, take a peek inside one of these church buildings and see what you see in there. It's really interesting. I don't want to go into any detail on that, but because of this, because they hung on to these Roman Catholic errors and abominations and still do, because of this, they can be rightly thought of as the harlot daughters of Babylon the Great, which is mentioned in Revelation chapter 17. Please keep all of that in mind now as an introduction. We're going to go into Duggar and Dodd's Church of God history again. Keep that in mind and see what Duggar and Dodd have to say about the effects, what happened, the effects of the Reformation on the true Church of God. Okay, I'm going to be not too many scriptures today, unfortunately, but I'll make up for that next time, I promise. A lot of reading here from various church historians, I hope you don't mind. But these are important things for us to know about how the church was scattered and why the church was scattered and what happened. Okay, talking about Luther here, and this is from Duggar and Dodd. Luther himself, while it is said, believed in and practiced the observance of the seventh-day Sabbath, did not prescribe it in his articles of faith for his followers in the copies that we now have access to. However, and he says this again, it has been said, so I'm not sure who said these things, but it has been said, he said, that in his original thesis, Luther advocated the observance of the seventh-day Sabbath, but that his colleagues objected on the grounds, listen to this, that it was an unpopular doctrine, which would have a tendency to repulse supporters of the Reformation who were not as pious as they should have been, but were of great assistance against the usurpations of the papacy. An unpopular doctrine. So we don't want to keep that because it's unpopular with the people. You know, Luther, in his works, has written of his belief in the Sabbath as follows, and this is pretty insipid. This is a quote from Luther now. The Sabbath was before the law of Moses came, and has existed from the beginning of the world. Especially have the devout, who have preserved the true faith, met together and called upon God on this day. Now, that's all he says about it. That's it from Luther. Not very convincing, not very supportive. you think that if you really did believe in the keeping of the true seventh-day Sabbath, that he'd have much more to say and write about it than this really single sentence or two sentences, small paragraph, tiny, weak-willed, insipid, and watered-down paragraph here. Okay, back to Duggar and Dodd now. And this is a very important historic statement here. As the Reformation became a success, remember that, became a success, many from among the ancient Waldensian churches of God, listen to it now, were drawn over to the bodies of believers coming out of Rome's system under the Reformers and left the main tenets of the faith held so dear by the Waldensian church. I'm going to read that again because that's supremely important. As the Reformation became a success, many from among the ancient Waldensian churches of God were drawn over to the bodies of believers coming out of Rome's system under the Reformers and left the main tenets of the faith held so dear by the Waldensian churches. That is the break right there. That is the departure from the faith once delivered. So if you're wondering where the Waldensians are today, that's why we don't consider them as brethren today. It's so sad. You think of all of their, and you read that in this Duggar and Dodd, you read that all of their, that their forefathers had endured, it's almost unbelievable. And it reminds me, I think of the Gog and Magog apostasy at the end of the millennium, and it reminds me of, you think, these people had stuck with it for so long, and they knew that it was right, and then they threw it all in. But anyway, some of them, and we don't know how many, we don't have any numbers, some of them rejected this protective fellowship with the Lutherans, and they stuck with the truth of the Bible. Back to Duggar and Dodd. It says, but the Church of God itself, made up of the faithful who knew and practiced the truths, maintained at the price of the lives of their foreparents in past centuries, kept the true gospel free from the corruptions that crept into doctrines of the new Protestant sects through the reformers who came from among the Roman clergy. Okay. A quote now from the Baptist Encyclopedia of 1881. It says, in 1530, in the year 1530, according to Dupin, I don't know who that was, Dupin, the Waldenses united with reformers and were persuaded to renounce certain peculiarities which heretofore they held and to receive doctrines which till then had been foreign to their creed. You can see what's happening there. And this is a quote now from J. Wiley in his History of the Waldenses. He says, in the middle of the 16th century, the breath of Protestantism from the north, Germany, began to move over these Italian colonies. He calls it the breath of Protestantism. I'd call it the bad breath of Protestantism. The pastors who visited them told them of the synod council meeting, which had been held in Angronia in 1532. Trish and I went there, this little village of Angronia, in 1532, and which had been as the beginning of months to the ancient church of the valleys. The beginning of months, he says, and that's a phrase that should jump out at all of us, quoted from Exodus chapter 12 and verse 2. After our recent calendar studies, I don't know why Wiley would have put that phrase in there. I'm not really sure, but it really kind of jumped out at me. But let's continue with what he says. And this is Wiley now, who is he's actually speaking up for the departure of the Waldenses from the true faith. But look what he calls it. He says, more glorious tidings still did they communicate to the Christians of Calabria. Calabria is right down at the toe of Italy, down right down the south there. So he's talking, Wiley is talking about the Waldenses getting tied up with the Lutherans, and he refers to that as glorious tidings. Continue with what he says. In Germany, in France, in Switzerland, and in Denmark, the old gospel had blazed forth in a splendor unknown to it for ages. Listen to this now. The lamp of the Alps, okay, of the Waldenses there, was no longer the one solitary light in the world. Around it was a circle of mighty torches whose rays, blending with those of the old luminary, the Waldenses, were combining to dispel the night from Christendom. To dispel the light, the night from Christendom. But Wiley was wrong, absolutely wrong. They weren't doing anything of the sort. What they were doing is they were allowing the Lutheran pseudo-Roman Catholic darkness to quench the brilliant light that so many true believers had died for. Yes, they were combining, all right, but what they were doing is that they were falling for the old adage, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And in doing that, the Waldenses unwisely linked themselves with the Lutheran Protestants, and in doing that, they were hoodwinked by Satan into combining with one of his newly born daughters of the Roman Catholic harlot. Wiley is implying here that it would have been acceptable to God for the one solitary light of the old gospel, in other words, the Waldenses, the Albigenses, the Anabaptists, the Cathari, that it would be acceptable to God for them to be blended with these new mighty encircling torches, as he said, these pseudo-Roman Catholic torches. And when I see the word torches there, I ask myself, what kind of light could these pseudo-Roman Catholic torches give off? And it reminds me of what Jesus said, and Jesus gives the answer to this question. He is the primary light of the world, and he is also the head of the body, and the body is the church of God. Just turn over briefly to Matthew chapter 6, please. Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 22. Matthew 6, 22. The light of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye be single, your whole body shall be full of light. Verse 23. But if your eye be evil, your whole body shall be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you be darkness, how great is that darkness? Okay, so you see what they're saying there is that the Waldenses, at, you know, you apply that to them and what happened there, and did Wiley there, he's looking at this as light, but what Jesus says is, if the light that is in you be darkness, how great is that darkness? Okay. Earlier we read that Duggar and Dodd were referring there to the success of the Reformation. Although it was only a partial success, that success was Satan's success. And I can't speak for those Waldenses. I can't speak for them, against them. For some of those brethren, after they'd been through so much, it might have been the very last straw for them. maybe many of them just couldn't take it anymore, and perhaps they excused themselves by thinking that as the Lutherans were partially like-minded with themselves, especially as far as opposition to the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church was concerned, that was near enough. They also may have thought by joining forces with the Lutherans that they would have strength in numbers and the possibility for a bit more protection. I don't know, I can't speak for them. But now, as we follow them into the 17th century, we see that by teaming up with the Lutherans, that did not give the Waldensians who did so the protection that they might have expected, certainly not right away anyway. Things improved later on. Think about it, like the Pope and the supporters of the Pope did not take too kindly to the Reformation, and a couple of wars were fought over it, and the best known one is called a 30 Years' War, and that raged from 1618 to 1648. I think about it, and I think about this war and the resultant scattering that came about from the war, and I wonder if it was similar to the punishments that God sent on ancient Israel and Judah because of their backsliding and because of their faithless alliances with Gentile armies, enemies. The 30 Years' War was ended by a treaty, and the treaty was called the Peace of Westphalia. But although the mainstream Protestant groups and the Waldensians who had joined them were protected in that treaty, the true remaining Church of God groups were not. They were not. The ones who stuck to the faith once delivered were not protected. They were out on their own. The Roman Catholics' persecution continued against those who had not joined with the Lutherans, those who were hanging on to the truth for dear life and for dear eternal life. But those who had joined the Protestant reformers had renounced many of their former true beliefs to the point that this happened, and this happened quite recently, and that joining and that homogenization with the Protestant movement had a big effect, and it came all the way through, and I'll jump forward now to 1975, not too long ago. In 1975, the Waldensian this is from Wikipedia, by the way. In 1975, the Waldensian Evangelical Church, and right in Wikipedia, calls it the original church in Italy, merged with the Methodist Evangelical Church to form the Union of Methodist and Waldensian Churches. Okay. The Waldensians have a community in the town of Valdese, which is another word for Waldensians, Valdese, and it's in North Carolina in the USA. And just before Trish and I went over to Italy there in the spring this year, I got in touch with the people in Valdese there, talked to somebody in their museum, and I asked her a couple of questions about, you know, what's the best place to stay, what's the best village to stay in with the most Waldensian history, and she was very helpful. But I also asked her about the keeping of the Sabbath. I asked her whether or not the Waldensians had ever kept the seventh-day Sabbath. But this lady, and she was, you know, very knowledgeable in the museum, she didn't seem to know anything about it. She didn't want to talk about it. And evidently, it was of no importance to her. I continued to research on it, and I found out later that this North American branch of Waldenses over there in Valdez, now they've joined with the Presbyterian Church. Okay, the Presbyterian Church. So, I don't want to go into all of the beliefs of the Methodists or the Presbyterians. You can look into that yourself if you want to. But pretty well basically the same as most of the professing Christian organizations. Trish and I, we enjoyed the trip down there. We were disappointed in the trip that we didn't find much out, really, except that the modern Waldensians are very well respected in their communities down there, certainly, and they seem to be doing a lot of good works. That's fine. But to a great extent, they seem to be relying on their history, on their well-documented history of their former persecutions and their former faith. But, as we've just read, from the 16th century on, their main group lost most of what they'd been persecuted for. They lost it, or they gave it away. Even the knowledge of it, they seem to have even lost the knowledge of it. They seem to have become homogenized into mainstream Protestantism. And we need to take care that this does not happen to us, because there's pressure for those things to happen. Let's go back to the 17th century again. After this partial success of Satan, this partial success of getting many Waldensians and Anabaptists and Cathari, different groups, success of getting them to join forces with one of his harlot daughter churches, he left he left them alone. You know, once they made that decision, he got them in his pocket, right? So he didn't have to worry about them. And he was talking about Satan. He didn't have to worry about them. What he did then, he went after the faithful remnant who hung on to the truth. And that could possibly be an early fulfillment of Revelation chapter 12 and verse 17. And you're very familiar with it. Turn to it if you want. Revelation chapter 12 verse 17. And the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And that can be applied to those faithful brethren who stuck to it. So in other words, Satan had no interest in them anymore. Let the other ones go who'd gone with the Lutherans, and then concentrated on the faithful who remained. Okay, let's go back to Duggar and Dodd, and this statement now seems to be referring to those who hung on to the truth. The 17th century marks the crisis of persecution against the true people of God. In the ancient nations of Europe, the saints of God were scattered, there's that word scattered again, preserving the true faith, keeping the commandments of God, and living exemplary lives in the valleys and hills of the continent. But again, as we've seen, by that time, many of their brethren had renounced at least some of God's commandments and the true faith. Duggar and Dodd again. The time came, however, when the land became more thickly settled and the enemies of the truth were pressed against the settlements of the true children of God, and persecutions became more intense. The result was that these saints were driven from nation to nation, but finding no lasting asylum as the hordes of Rome followed them. Okay, so more and more scattering. Okay, another well-known and very important statement from Jesus, Matthew chapter 16, Matthew chapter 16 and verse 18. Just the one verse here, very well-known verse, Matthew 16, 18. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. We're going to come back to that verse again in a future sermon. But for now, just taking that last phrase, that the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. And of course, from many other prophetic scriptures as well, we can be absolutely sure that the true church of God would never die out, would never die out, and that there would always be at least one representative commandment-keeping group, however small, that would be the true spiritual children of God the Father and the true spiritual brothers and sisters of Jesus Christ. So now, as we've seen there, the official body of the Waldensians, the majority from what we understand, had basically dropped the ball. So that being the case, we need to start looking elsewhere for the light of truth. Back to Duggar and Dodd again. Still in the 17th century now, Duggar and Dodd mention a book here that is dated 1662. It was written, and we're all the way over to England now, written by a London Church of God member with the unusual name of Vavasor Powell. Vavasor, never heard that one before. Vavasor Powell. And it was addressed to some faithful Church of God brethren in Wales. The faithful brother and writer, talking about Powell, died in prison for the true faith. Died in prison for the true faith. And while in this confinement, wrote a book called The Chirpings of a Bird in a Cage, evidently referring to himself. He addressed this book to the churches of God and the scattered saints throughout all Wales. So he was in prison in London, and he was writing to the scattered saints throughout all of Wales. So imagine, you know, brethren, little gatherings of church brethren like ours all over Wales. What a lovely thought. Also, there's another, they talk about another document here. This one is a report dated 1668, and it mentions some Church of God groups in England, but now also for the first time in the fledgling United States of America. Okay, it says, in the year 1668, there were at least 9 Sabbatarian churches in England, according to a letter written from London by Dr. Edward Stennett of the Bell Lane Church to the Sabbath-keeping brethren in Rhode Island. And we quote, this is Duggar and Dodd, here are in England about 9 or 10 churches that keep the Sabbath, beside many scattered disciples who have been eminently preserved in this tottering day when many once eminent churches have been shattered to pieces. So really scattered, shattered brethren there. And that's dated February the 2nd, 1668, at Abingdon in Berkshire. Okay, referring again back to the Italian valleys now and the extermination of the churches in the valleys, a later 19th century historian by the name of Jones wrote this. I profess to give the history of the churches of Piedmont and other places commonly designated as Waldenses and Albigenses, not of individuals, as I considered these churches to have been utterly dispersed and scattered by a series of persecutions which terminated in the year 1686. Back to Duggar and Dodd now. This persecution was during the very same period that the pilgrims were coming to America to escape persecution. And when, according to the revelation of Jesus, chapter 12 and verse 16, that the earth helped the woman, the church, it was to America, the land of religious freedom, that the people known to the world as Waldenses, Puritans, Anabaptists, Lollards, and others were fleeing from persecution, and who were in general known by the scriptural name, the Church of God. So now what we're seeing here, as we move along in the history, we're seeing accounts here of some of God's people fleeing Europe and traveling all the way over to the New World. Okay, the New World had been opened up to emigrants from Europe for colonization, and the persecuted saints, known by various names in history, fled to America for a haven of safety. The pilgrims, the Puritans, the Quakers, had scattered among them the true Church of God, and carried with them to the shores of the New World the faith once delivered unto the saints, and preserved by their foreparents by the price of blood in the wildernesses of Europe. Now, Duggar and Dodd imply, when they write this, that these pioneering immigrant groups were not all true Church of God members. Never thought that they were. But what the implication is there, they included Church of God members who adhered to the true biblical tenets. But I can't help wondering, after what happened with the Lutherans, between the Waldenses and the Lutherans, I can't help wondering how pure or how tainted were the doctrines that these people, or at least some of them, brought to the New World. For example, did these pilgrims and Puritans and Quakers mentioned by Duggar and Dodd, did they ever keep the seventh day Sabbath, or did they ever keep God's holy days? Good question. Just on a sideline again, because of the actual date here in the 17th century, refers to Oliver Cromwell. Wiley's History of the Waldenses mentions that Oliver Cromwell was a devout Puritan, and that he participated in some of the international support for the Waldenses, and probably more accurately, against the Roman Catholic persecutors. If you're interested, I've got a really interesting book there of Cromwell's speeches and letters, and some of those letters that he wrote contain some supportive mentions of the Sabbath in there. So that's a pretty good read. Okay, still in Duggar and Dodd, the Church of God wandered, so they're on the move, they're scattering. The Church of God wandered from country to country, seeking that freedom of worship which the human heart craves, and had come at last to America, a scattered remnant. These humble servants established themselves in small congregations throughout the eastern states. So, right away, once they came to North America, we read of the continuing pattern for the Church of God, the path of the course, if you will, for the Church of God. And that was that pattern was of wandering and scattering, continuing movement. Duggar and Dodd again. During these early colonial days, congregations were at first isolated because of distance and a lack of means of travel, with no roads between them. Can you imagine what that was like? Thus, being isolated from fellowship with one another, we find companies, calls them companies, as the Bible does in some places, it means congregations. We find companies in one place called the Church of Christ and the Church of God, while in other communities they were simply called Sabbatarian congregations, but the belief was practically the same. They stood for the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus, observing the true Sabbath, keeping the Lord's Supper yearly on the 14th of the first month, with other tenets of faith in harmony with the true faith today. Owing to the isolation of these scattered companies or congregations, they were known by different names, which evidently gives rise to the scriptural statement relative to the Sardis period, "I know thy works, that thou hast a name," Revelation chapter 3 and verse 1. So the church's name was important to these people, and it still is today, still should be to us today. And that name, we believe, and still is the Church of God. I'm going to skip over a whole century, which is the 18th century, relatively uneventful, okay, as far as scattering of the church is concerned, relatively uneventful. And we're going to jump over to the church scatterings in the 19th century and the early 20th centuries. We're going to go back to Britain again. Duggar and Dodd now quoting from the history of the Seventh-day Baptists. After being dispossessed of their Milliard property in 1885, they met for worship in the Commercial Street Baptist Church until 1892, and then in the Welsh Baptist Church in Eldon Street, where once worshipped the Calvinistic Seventh-day Baptist Church, which became extinct about 1840. For some time since 1900, the congregation assembled in private houses, and to accommodate the widely scattered flock, two separate meetings were held, one at the residence of Lieutenant Colonel Thomas W. Richardson, and the other either at the home of the church secretary or at the home of the deacon. So they had living room groups just like we do today. Back over again to the United States. Just want to show the scattering there. The word scattering keeps coming out. Brethren scattered all over England and Wales and Scotland, and also over in the United States. State associations were formed and functioning in Missouri, Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, New York, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and in several of the southern states. Two gospel tents were paid for and in operation in the state of Iowa, and the other state associations had purchased tents which were in use, and churches and isolated brethren were scattered from one end of the country to the other. Okay, again, the name of the church was important to the brethren back then as well. That the church name at this time was the Church of God is evident from the early writings and experiences and views by the wife of James White, editor of the church paper. She wrote numerous volumes in which she frequently mentioned the name Church of God. Also, the first songbook published by these people is dedicated to the Church of God scattered abroad. Church of God scattered abroad. Finally, from Duggar and Dodd, at the end of their history here, in the early 20th century, we read of a congregation that met in the tiny village of Wilbur, West Virginia. Wilbur, just like the pig, you know. Church of God ministers at Wilbur have ever had to defend the word of truth, and three debates have been held with those who wish to know the truth of the scriptures. The truth has ever been verified in these discussions, and the Church of God has continued to stand with it. Today, we believe that what he refers to 1936 there, the Wilbur Church does not stand alone, but other companies, or congregations, and scattered members, there again, hold aloft the true faith over the state. Not only so, but the headquarters for the work in the United States is located at Salem, West Virginia, and from there the faith once delivered unto the saints is going rapidly to those who have not heard. So, that's an amazing history, and I certainly recommend that you read it. But that's it, basically, from Duggar and Dodge Church of God history. Now we move beyond Duggar and Dodd as we move into the later 20th century. I'm not going to go into all of the detail on the recent histories of the various Church of God groups, but for now I just want to continue with the history of the scattering of God's church and to bring it up to date to our day today. And I'll just give a brief listing of the major or some of the major Church of God groups that I'm aware of in something of a time order. And I know that there were and there are, of course, lots and lots of splinter groups that I won't list here, so don't be offended if I leave out some of your favourites. But here are just some of the main ones, including some of the ones that we've been associated with. And what I'm trying to get at here is to show you the dates and that the scattering continues, okay? So Duggar and Dodd, initially they were Seventh-day Baptists, and then they were Church of God Seventh-day. The Seventh-day Adventists were in there as well, and backwards and forwards as to whether we believe that they were true brethren or not, but that's not my choice. So Church of God Seventh-day was officially started by a man named Gilbert Cranmer in approximately 1852, and the Church of God Seventh-day still exists today. You know, you can find one of their congregations. I used to have one in Vancouver. I don't know whether it's still there. You could go to one of their services and you would be probably quite comfortable there. And then from them we have Herbert W. Armstrong, and when he split off, he attended with them for a while, and then he split off in 1934, and he started the Radio Church of God, and that changed to the Worldwide Church of God in 1946. Loads of history behind that, and well documented by Mr. Armstrong in his autobiographies and in lots of other documents as well. Splits going on there that I don't want to go into. One of the major ones was in 1978 when Garner Ted Armstrong went out and started Church of God International, CGI, 1978. And then a huge turmoil after Mr. Armstrong died in 1986. And one of the first ones to leave after the To Catch era of the Worldwide Church of God was Church of the Great God, John Reitenbaugh and that group, and that was in 1991, January 1991. Shortly after, Dr. Meredith, Roderick Meredith, and the Global Church of God, right, 1992. And I found out, reading up on these things, that the Global Church of God still exists in the UK. I thought it was dead as a dodo, but no, it still exists, and it's associated with a group called the Church of the Eternal God. Yeah. Okay. 1995, the United Church of God. Also, and that was a huge one when a whole bunch of literally thousands of people left worldwide, and the United Church of God was formed. And in the same year, Ronald Dawes formed the Christian Educational Ministries. I thought that was interesting. I wondered when he'd started, in 1995 as well. All was not well in Global, and Roderick Meredith, I don't even know, I can't even follow the history. I read it and I was totally confused about it. But anyway, what came out of that was it was a bunch of different groups came out of that split, and say that the major, probably the best known one now is Living Church of God, came out of that, and that was in 1998. In the same year, David Hume split off from United, and he formed a church called Church of God, an international community, I think it's called. And so that was David Hume. And because they had the name the Church of God, he thought that that was the only true Church of God, you know. And that nothing, you know, that he would suffer no splits. Anyway, also 1998, Garner Ted Armstrong, won't say much more about that, but he formed an organization called the Intercontinental Church of God. That was 1998, out of CGI. And also another in 2009, and I kept looking at when Worldwide turned away from the truth and started going Protestant. I thought they've got to get rid of that name Church of God. That something's got to happen there. And eventually it did. In 2009, they changed the name from the Worldwide Church of God to Grace Community. Is it Grace Community? Community International, something like that. Yeah, GCI. To see it, it just continues over the years. And then in 2010, there was a huge split in United, which produced Church of God Worldwide Association, which is COGWA, right? And then still over and over, split. And then 2014, Brian Orchard and some other brethren split off from David Hume's group, the Unsplittable, and formed Church of God, the Father's Call. So probably more since then, in the last 2 years since then, but I don't know about them. But that's the last split. So scattering. And I'm sure that I've missed lots out. There's one listing of them that's over 400, and I've seen another listing that's probably over, I think it must be 500 or 600, and you just can't keep up with it. So scattering, lots of splits. And again, you know, going back, we don't think about, we think about all of these splits as a modern thing, but they're not. You know, you go back into Church of God Seventh Day and read about that, and there's all kinds of splits there. And during the years of Worldwide, when you really, you know, you thought, you know, that everything was quite stable. No, it wasn't. And there were all kinds of major ministers leaving and starting their own church groups. Okay, so it goes, literally hundreds of Church of God splinter groups and countless living room groups just like ours. So we basically completed the history of the scattering of God's people. We've gone all the way from Adam and Eve through Abraham and come up all to the Church of God today in the 21st century. We could leave it right there, but I feel that I can't finish off the series without going into a couple of important loose ends. A couple of loose ends that need to be tied up before we complete this study series. We're almost out of time for today, but I'd just like to spend the last few minutes of the sermon today just to get started into these important loose ends, and we'll continue with them next time. And the question here then, once again, how does all this scattering, all this separation, all of this travelling, both physical and doctrinal, of the patriarchs, the Old Covenant Israelites, Jesus, the disciples, the apostles, the early church, the later church, how does it all apply to you and me? Practically, how does it apply to you and me and to all of God's people today? We look at what they did. We look at what they did, and we ask the question, you know, does Jesus want us to quit our jobs, sell our homes, and hit the road, just like our early forefathers did? I don't believe so. I think I've said that before. But in a spiritual way, just like when God first called Abraham, so it was with all of us. When God the Father first called us into his church and we accepted his call, he started us on a journey. He wanted us to effectively to follow his son Jesus on Jesus' gospel preaching travels that he had begun in his earthly ministry. 17 times in the gospel accounts we read of Jesus saying, follow me, follow me. And this one repeated phrase over and over again implies the need for Jesus' brothers and sisters for movement and travel, sometimes physically and sometimes spiritually. Please turn to Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9. And I'm going to cut into a thought here in verse 56. Luke 9, 56. And we see Jesus and his disciples on the move again. The second half of verse 56, and they went to another village. And it came to pass that as they went in the way, they were traveling, a certain man said unto him, Lord, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said unto him, foxes have holes, and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has not anywhere to lay his head. Just like Abraham, Jesus and his disciples forsook their permanent physical homes in order to go out on the road. And just like the traveling salesman of Herbert Armstrong's early life, Jesus and his disciples were permanently on the move from town to town, from village to village. And basically, Jesus was saying to this man who wanted to volunteer to join up, he said, paraphrasing, if you really want to follow me, that's great. But I feel that I should warn you that if you do follow me, you'll be living a somewhat nomadic lifestyle. Continuing still in Luke 9 here, verse 59. And he said unto another, follow me. But he said, Lord, suffer me first to go and bury my father. And Jesus said unto him, let the dead bury their dead, but go you and preach the kingdom of God. And another also said, Lord, I will follow you, but let me first go bid them farewell which are at home at my house. And Jesus said unto him, this is interesting now, no man, having put his hand to the plough and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. Now, I hadn't really thought of this in this way before, but if you think about it, it's totally impossible for a farmer to plough his fields standing still. It's totally impossible for a farmer to plough his fields in the same place. It doesn't work. He has to keep moving, and he has to keep moving forward. Once God the Father called and chose us, you and me, brethren, we started to move spiritually. Yeah, we started to move away from our former beliefs and practices. But in effect, we also hit the road spiritually, following his son Jesus in doing our part with and under him in the preaching of the gospel of the kingdom. And this being so, we too must adopt a kind of spiritually nomadic lifestyle. And we too must have no desire for the trappings and the permanence, I say permanence, quote unquote, of this world and this human life, because I think we all know by now that these things are not permanent, that the physical trappings of the world are merely smoke and mirrors. They basically might seem solid, but all they are is groups of electrons orbiting other groups of electrons. That's all they are. And although Satan has almost the whole world convinced to the contrary, the spiritual is what actually is the true reality.